This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the return of Province Sports Radio. We are still here. I am Paul Chapman. I am here joined, as we are, with Ed Willis every Friday when we do a podcast.
Yeah, can I understand why you'd forget?
Yeah, but here we are anyway, so let's talk some sports, Ed. Eric Rolfson, another former sports editor here at the Province, and myself had a bit of a laugh this morning about which is the worst weekend of the year. Is it the, or which period of the year? Is it that time before and after the baseball all-star break when there's nothing going on, or is it this weekend where we have two all-star games? We're staring down the end of the NFL season, and there's no real hockey. The NHL all-star game has gone so far off the map in terms of entertainment and relevance that I don't even know what we talk about from it. So we fill the void by talking about the Canucks here. and filling the void is really a great way to put it. What's your impression of this team at this stage?
I may be a minority of one here, but I still view this season by and large as a success. And I think we've been saying it all along. You can't measure it by wins and losses. You have to measure by what's happening with the kids, what's happening with the team's culture going forward, what's happening with its makeup. And I think all those things are pointed in generally a positive direction. Now what that's going to look like a couple of years from now, that's the thing which is yet to be determined. But I think if you were going into this season, they've identified five players who are all 22 and under who look like they're going to be fixtures on this team for the next 5, 6, 7 years. And I think that's what makes it a success.
Or I think around the last time we talked, we had a situation where the Canucks had gone on this road trip where they were facing, you know, Columbus and Toronto, Buffalo. They were facing that, and they looked dreadful. And the kids weren't scoring, and they looked like they were regressing. And then sort of out of nowhere, they played a couple of good teams, and the Sedins have been, you know, doing the heavy lifting the whole season. And all of a sudden, Sven Barchi starts scoring. Bo Horvat, golden boy, who everyone was now starting to turn on, gets on this a little bit of a streak and scores some goals. And do we underestimate sometimes, in particular with a young player, how important confidence is in your game?
Yeah, I don't think so. And it takes many, many different forms. And it all comes out at the end. And I think especially in Horvat's case, you know, and it really is about managing expectations. After the second half of his season, everybody, and myself included, I had him penciled in for 20 goals, 50 points, and him really to start taking a leadership role in this team, which is, when you think about it, way too much task for a 20-year-old. But it's funny, when everybody stopped thinking he was going to score is when he takes off. And I think you can make similar cases, you know, with the other kids, in the lineup. So it's, there are a lot of variables in the equation. And the development is such a tricky thing in the NHL, but that's why I still think by and large they're going about it the right way. And I think the Sedin's presence here is the key to the whole thing. I don't think it'll ever get that far off the rails as long as they're here. And I think those kids, and there's a lot more coming, can look, and that's what we want to be. That's what we want to represent.
Well, and the Sedins have been remarkable, Ed, but I've seen some stuff lately that suggests that, you know, we all thought that these were their last 2 years, and yeah, okay, they're playing at an elite level, they're gonna go out, and you know, I was and am still in the camp of, if they can't win a Stanley Cup here and they would bring a big return, maybe you would look at dealing them when they don't have a lot left on their contract. But now I'm just starting to hear some inklings about them maybe signing and playing. Yeah, I believe Henrik commented and said, maybe I can play till I'm 40. Now I know they've suffered some injuries, but you know, is that story for the Canucks changing a little bit, that instead of the Sedins winding down, they can still be like, have another one more step in the development of these young guys?
Yeah, I think it is. And it's worth watching. And it's interesting when you look around the league and the aging patterns. There is that rare guy who stays relevant into his late 30s and even into it, and even when by the time he hits 40. Jaromir Jagr is the most obvious example. Teemu Selanne was that guy and into his 40s. Datsyuk and Zetterberg, they're injury prone, unfortunately, but they're still high, high impact players when they're healthy. So it's possible the Twins, I think, turned 35 this year. A lot of tread on the tire. I understand they've been playing in the NHL since they were 20. But if they can make it to that 38, 39, that buys the Canucks 4 years to build a team around them, one that should be theoretically ready to go when they do step away.
Your impression of the young players, I mean, again, I really don't want to revisit the goat gate with Virtanen, but he seems to be so level headed through the whole thing. And yeah, he's not going to score you 50 goals and win scoring titles, but he's still got a very unique package. You know, when you look at guys that age in terms of what he can do, I look at McCann and the skills he brings and they're different. Horvat, you talked about, and what his projections are this year and beyond. And Hutton, we've started to see a few more mistakes lately, but he's, certainly looks like he's a guy who's young and he's going to be, they can count on this guy for a long time. I'm not saying that direct comparison to the Oilers who drafted the same style of player all the way through. Mm-hmm. What I like about this Canucks group is they fit together in a larger vision. Don't you agree?
That's a terrific point. And it's because I've talked about this with Botchford a couple of times. The Virtanen pick doesn't look great when you see what Dylan Larkin is doing in Detroit and Nick Ehlers is doing in Winnipeg. I just don't think the Canucks could have drafted another smallish skilled forward. And because then you're starting to fall into that Edmonton brings to the table is very hard to find. And he really is kind of the prototypical modern power forward. It's just another conversation we have in the press box. That kind of Keith Kachuk Bertuzzi guy who played at 235, 240 pounds, he really doesn't exist anymore because the game is so fast. The model now is a guy like Virtanen who's 210, can keep up to the speed of the game, but still play physically, still win puck battles, still be a presence. And that is what the Canucks have been lacking for so long, and he at least gives them going that. And further to your point, I think Jared McCann down the road is going to be a classic second-line center. I think he will probably get you the 20-25 goals and the 50 points. I think Hutton could be a nice piece. And let's say, you know, Tanev is still mid-20s. Yeah. You know, he's going to be around for a while. So, you know, they've got two pieces on the defense, and that's really the biggest challenge for this organization is building a blue line.
It is funny. Just a quick point on Virtanen, and we get so distracted by the, you know, the shiny necklaces and everything else. So McCann scores a great goal off a wrist shot, and everyone's like, "Wow, that was great." Just simple things like Virtanen willing to get into the Bruins' end and throw a shoulder at Zdeno Chara, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's a small play. It didn't really result in anything great for the Canucks. But that's the kind of, you see, if a guy doing it at that age, you're absolutely right. You don't have to be a 250-pound beast to add the grit the Canucks have been looking for since 2011. So, yeah, the makeup of this team, at the very least, give Jim Benning and Trevor Linden the credit for going in that way. Another quick point before we move off the Canucks. We look at this team always and we'll say things. And not, when I say we, I'm talking about media and fans. Yes, we want the young players to play. Yes, we realize they won't win a Stanley Cup or this year. And we're willing to have those growing pains, but they do go through a 10-game stretch like they did. Everyone is antsy. And then when the little bounce back comes, as you said, this is kind of what we thought they'd be. The projections will be where they're going to be. But when you're in the midst of those horrendous streaks, everyone starts to panic. So what do you expect now in the second? Well, it's not in the second half, last third of the season.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the last three games are a pretty good indication of what's going to come. That is, you know, they're going to be close. They're going to be competitive. Ultimately, they're just not going to get there because they don't have the pieces to compete. Now, having said that, the one thing they do have in their favor for the first time all season is the schedule. And when I looked at it, I was astonished at what's coming up for them. 19 of their last 32 are at home. 18 of them are against Pacific Coast teams. And like I wrote the other day, that's not exactly the group of death. They're not in the
sleep talker will be happy at least anyway, right?
Exactly. I don't think it applied to the fans though, but no games in the East. two in the Central, and everything else is in Western time zones. So on that basis, it shapes up. I like I said, I just don't see them ultimately getting there. Cause I don't think they're better than, I don't think they're better than Anaheim. I don't think they're better than San Jose. And that's really what it comes down to.
So we'll see immediately after the All-Star break what the team is looking like and where they sit. And then what will be fascinating to me is the trade deadline.
Absolutely.
And I know it's been overhyped year after year after year. And my God, I can't stomach any more panel talk.
We still have 4 weeks to go too.
No, I know, but it's, I just think through the, not even the lens, through the dream catcher in Jim Benning's office as we look through this. I think that there are so many unique directions this team could go philosophically. Stockpile picks, go and get ready-made players. Give up on some veterans. And I'm not talking about Chris Higgins. That's a couple of pennies you find in the little cup holder in your car. I'm talking about real assets and where you go. And I wonder if they have in their mind sort of locked in what they're going to stick to, or if they're sort of like, well, no, if the team goes on a run here, maybe we look for something that's a little more immediate and give up a draft pick instead of collecting them. I think what they do here is going to be fascinating in this trade deadline.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a given for Verbata moves simply because he really isn't giving them enough now. And believe it or not, there is a bit of a market for him.
Of course.
It's not a high-end market, but you know, like, and I think if they can get a second-round draft pick for him, which isn't out of the realm of possibility when you look at what Antoine Vermette went for at last year, at last year's deadline, that's, to me, the real test case is Ham Hughes, who I think has real value. I know a lot of Canucks fans might snicker, but no matter what else he is a veteran presence on the blue line who, in a pinch, could fit on any top four in the league over the short term.
Absolutely.
And I think that has real value, and I think now you're talking about maybe a mid-first rounder, maybe you're talking about a second rounder, and that kind of A-minus, B-plus prospect that Benning has done quite well with.
Yeah.
You know, getting the Bear Cheese, getting Emerson Edom. So I really think Ham Hughes is the one Canucks fans should look for, and that'll really signal the direction this organization is going.
And there are some, you know, you talk about two, you need a partner to do that, right? And if I look around the league, you know, certainly you look at the train wrecks that's Montreal with such high expectations there. You know, unfortunately, I know they won't do the deal within their division, but Anaheim, you know, there are teams out there that are going to need help at the deadline and may be willing to overpay. And you're right, they have a couple of pieces that might actually get them something.
I think the ship has sailed with Anaheim.
I
don't think there's a great fear there because they've already sent two fairly significant players over there.
Absolutely. But you know what I mean is just that at the deadline, Anaheim is a team that's going to need some help to get over the hump. And they went in thinking they were contenders. Montreal did. The Rangers have been out of sorts all season. I think there are teams here who really will be willing to be that partner and pick up some of those pieces. So, and that's where I said I find it fascinating. So that's the Canucks at the break. I guess more of the same afterwards. Quickly, Willie Desjardins. Again, as you said, we don't judge on wins and losses this year. People were ready to get rid of Willie a month ago. It was people, the fans were just really, really, upset with him. I think he does not have the personality that endears himself to the fan base the way Alain Vigneault did. Comically, Tortorella, no one wanted Tortorella to stay, but fans had their opinions on him because of his personality. Mark Crawford, same thing. Willie Desjardins, I just think, is too bland for people to say, oh no, he's a great guy. I like having him around. He's really good for the Canucks. But again, patience with these young players, and you're finally starting to see some rewards. Long term, is this the guy?
This one to me is maybe the most interesting question around the Canucks. And I would answer this way. And I think, you know, I wrote this. When you look at the big things, that's the development of the players. Does the team play hard every night? Are they competitive? Are they about where people thought they were, even maybe a little better? Tick, 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 tick. Yeah. Checks all those boxes. The one thing I will say about Willie is there are just too many games where you leave scratching your head going, why did he do that? Why did they do that? Why did they take that too many minutes? Why did they make a line change there? And I think going forward, like when it's just so competitive and the margin of error is so small, I'm just not sure if you can have those questions hanging over a team. I don't think it really matters with the Canucks as they're currently constructed, but if they do get to the point where they're legitimate, you know, a legitimate playoff team, maybe even with aspirations of a deeper playoff run, I just think you might need a different guy there. Yeah. Just a better in-game manager.
Yeah. That, well, that's going to be interesting to see how that evolves again, because you look, whether it's the trade deadline, then moving into the offseason, free agency next year, you see the potential fork in the road for this team, and you wonder about the coach.
Yeah.
Again, though, as I always look at with the coach, is what is your plan B? It's one thing to get rid of him, but who comes in? But
yeah,
we'll see that. Lastly, we'll touch on the Super Bowl. You send me the notes for what you want to talk about this weekend. You have, are the Panthers really a super team? And I have not been this perplexed about a team for a long time. I've been expecting them to fall on their face, Ed. I'll admit it. I do like Cam Newton. I love that defense. But I thought they should have lost in Seattle. They were very fortunate to win that game. There were a couple of other games where I felt they were quite fortunate as well. And if you look at the playoff game, I know you were there, really a couple of dumb mistakes by the Seahawks eliminate those plays and the Seahawks win that game. But I can't get away from their dominance. It's just like they are, they have a swagger, whether it's true or not, they believe it's true. And right now they're feeding off it.
I would say this, they're not really doing it in the orthodox fashion in a way that football fan. Oh yeah, we've seen that before. Cam Newton plays that position different than anybody I think has ever played it. There's never been that combination of athleticism and power and strength with the guy with a good arm who's actually can manage the game now.
Well, come on, you're overlooking Jamarcus Russell.
That's true. I know. There was a great conversation on the NFL Network about how Newton followed Jamarcus Russell, and it came back to the black quarterback.
Yeah,
and I'm sorry, I'm just drawing a blank. I'm pretty sure the Cincinnati Bengals drafted
Kelly Smith.
No, it wasn't him. It was Jamarcus Russell, and it was another one of these kind of big guy who put up huge numbers and was a man playing against boys.
In
college. That doesn't matter. So there was kind of the perception that he was going to be that guy. He was going to be just like another bust. And when you saw him early, he was so raw, you know, and he could make plays just because of his athleticism. But what I've seen here is a guy, like, I don't think he's going to make anybody forget, you know, Joe Montana or Peyton Manning as far as being a surgeon. But the other elements he brings are just so dangerous. And as long as he stays healthy, I think he's a different
speaker. Well, yeah, I mean, I liked Cam Newton at Auburn. He had this issue where he stole someone's laptop.
Vince Young,
you're thinking of, who was just arrested this week on a DUI. Oh, but there you go. Yeah. But, you know, I remember that year, of course, the Bengals have always been looking for a quarterback, and they were really interested in drafting Newton, and he was ranked around 11th after the season. But at the combine, he was one of these guys that, regardless of the game tape, he started to rise when people saw, and because you're right, he's like Steve Young with 60 pounds of muscle.
Yeah. it's a great comparison,
And the Bengals had the fourth pick that year, and I was really hoping, you know, here's Newton ranked 11th, and I wanted them to take him, being a Bengals fan. Carolina takes him first, all this pressure on him, everything else. Bengals ended up taking AJ Green with the fourth pick, not bad, and then got their quarterback in Dalton the following year in the second round. But Newton had that thing where so I always sort of compared him to Dalton because they were taken the same year and there was this dichotomy of the franchises. And he was making those mistakes early, and he had a couple of funny press conferences. And again, whether the race thing plays into it, there was a lot of crap around Cam Newton about too much swagger, too cocky, not working hard enough. And I honestly don't think you would have got those same criticisms of Matthew Stafford, let's say.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And remember, there was a couple of incidents when he was in college. He took a computer.
Yeah.
You know, he went to Florida, and there was payments under the table and everything that fit the stereotype, right?
Yeah.
Everything that, and that's why I find myself pulling for the kid.
Absolutely.
Because he breaks those stereotypes. And okay, look, I was around him for a couple of days in the divisional game with Seattle. And I'm sorry, I found him to be endlessly attractive as a personality. Funny. He goes off script in his press conferences. He did this great thing about why he isn't on the, why aren't I on the hands team? Because Thomas Davis recovered the onside kick. It was was a nice little moment there, but I think it speaks to the kid. And, you know, he's 26. It would be really interesting to see if he can develop into that NFL poster boy.
Well, and the funny thing, Ed, is he doesn't, number one, he doesn't have a any sort of notable receiver at the moment, with Benjamin getting injured in training camp. Obviously, Olsen is his big safety valve, a great tight end, and he's leaned on him. But if you put a couple of quality wide receivers around this guy, it's limitless what they can do, because he creates that dilemma for the defense. And when he gets outside in the pocket, it's not going to be easy for a linebacker to get a hold of him. And when they come up, that's when he's hitting that tight end in the middle. So he does create a bit of a dilemma, because he is unique for this game. And I know we've got time. Maybe we'll do, hopefully we'll get another podcast in next week. But, you know, I know there's all this story about Peyton Manning and everything else. As great as Denver's defense is, I can't see this game being close.
No, neither do I. And it was funny. Like, the line started at 3 for Carolina, and it's already 5, 5.5.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't surprise me if it got to 6, 6.5, even 7 by kickoff. Like I said, I see this as being very similar to the Denver-Seattle, for different reasons, but very similar to the Denver-Seattle Super Bowl.
Except, going into that Super Bowl, I actually thought it would be close. I thought the Broncos had a shot in that one, and the Seahawks just blew them out of the water.
Think that on the first play of the game?
No, well, that's it. No, that's what I mean. For the very first play of the game, that the stage was set there. But you've been to Super Bowls. I've been to Super Bowls. It is different when you're there. I'm not playing the elitist media card, but I know what you're talking about with Cam Newton. Deion Sanders and Michael Irvin were with the Dallas Cowboys at the first Super Bowl that I went to, and I found it endlessly fascinating to just sit and listen to them, and that you're drawn to their charisma. There's something that you can't describe about an athlete like that, and what they do for their teammates and how it adopts the personality of that team. And I know Michael Irvin, Deion Sanders too, had a ton of crap off the field, but there was something about them. I found myself by the end of the week, there's 10,000 people asking the stupid questions on media day. By the time you get to Thursday, guys are too hungover to go to media access, and there's about a tenth of the people there. But even when I had enough stuff for my stories, I was drawn to those guys just to listen to them. They were such big personalities. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Cam Newton does this week with the media attention there. And I know, again, there's the Peyton Manning story. There's Carolina's defense. Keekly's a great story. Thomas Davis wants to play with a broken arm. There's so many great pieces there. But I think Cam Newton is going to grab this week by the neck.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There are stars, Super Bowl game, almost as important. There are stars of Super Bowl week.
And
Cam Newton is going to be the star, and he is going to be the subject of so much national attention.
Good and bad.
He's still a relatively fresh face, but I think 90% of it is going to come out on the positive side for the reasons we've talked about. Because he is an attractive personality, because he is something new, because he plays the position so much differently than anybody else, and because he's really kind of risen above a lot of the crap that surrounded him early on. So, yeah, really looking forward to this. Like, I know we got to go here, but I've got a quick get off my lawn segment.
Excellent.
Because I was at the Prospects game last night, and I'm sorry, it's still a thrill for me to be in the presence of Bobby Orr. He came out and did a scrum, and we chatted for about 5 minutes, and he was wonderful. And I kept looking at him, and I'm going, you know, these kids he's coached, they're old enough to be his grandchildren. And he was still excited to be around it, and he was wonderful in the scrum. So I just wanted to get that in. And talked about the night they had for Pat Quinn, and you know, think Bobby Orr, you think Pat Quinn, and clearly it meant a lot to him. So that was a really nice moment.
Yeah, I know you have to get going, Ed, so we can't really expound on that. But two things. I think it's a bit of a tragedy what's happened with Bobby Orr, and the fact that if he was playing today, he'd probably be a $15 million a year player.
Yep.
I don't think he's hurting for money, but he has never sort of cashed in on his name the way a real superstar of the game has. He's in the sort of scouting agent business, but he's not the biggest name there. I know he tried coaching very briefly, hasn't done the front office thing. It is wonderful to see him still involved with the game, but for a guy who really people will argue is a top two talent, I know there's also Gretzky and Lemieux in that conversation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people still think that Bobby Orr is the greatest that ever played. It is a little bit sad to me that he hasn't he's not the superstar after the fact that he played the way he should be.
He is Joe Montana. He's Michael Jordan. He is every bit at that level. And hockey does, I mean, look, we can kill a whole show on this. Yeah. In fact, we'll book it. They do such a shitty job telling their stories and promoting their own heroes. And we can go over the number of reasons, but it's a travesty. It is a travesty. That guy is still that young, still that relative, and he isn't a face of the game.
Absolutely.
But that's, Gary Bettman is. Yeah, Give me a break.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that we'll get into at another time, our editor-in-chief, Wayne Moriarty, who is a die-hard Habs fan, gleefully posed with Bobby Orr for a picture and sent it to me and put it on his Facebook page as well. And I was just shaking my head at him. He still doesn't understand it because as a Liverpool fan, David Beckham, I would not get my picture taken with David Beckham. I could not get, no matter Wayne Rooney, no matter how great they are the enemy when they're Manchester United. For a Habs fan to actually put his arm around a Bruins, I think Bobby Orr does transcend that, though. That's a story for another day. Quickly, though, before we go, I know you have to rush off. Who wins the Pro Bowl, Team Irvin or Team Rice?
I'm coming off an All-Star game last night. I think it's just asking too much of me to invest in another one. And let's not get
Team
started,
Irvin's gonna win by 10 points.
Started on the NHL All-Star game, too, because I'm just too excited to
get off my lawn, indeed. Yeah. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will endeavor to do these every week. We will be back next Friday. Thanks, Ed.